Welcome to the Oncology on the Go podcast in collaboration with the American Psychosocial Oncology Society, hosted by Daniel C. McFarland. In this collaborative interview, Daniel C. McFarland was joined by Michelle Reba from the University of Michigan discussing integrating psychosocial care into oncology. The pair delved into distress screening and the evolution of the guidelines since their inception in 1998. Additionally, a collaborative care model was discussed as a way to enhance the oncologist's role in psychosocial care.
Hello, welcome. Thank you, everyone, for listening today. I have the pleasure of being with Michelle Reba, who is a psycho-oncologist, has been doing this work for a very long time and highly experienced, especially in the areas of distress screening. Most oncologists at different cancer centers struggle with the idea of how exactly do we bring psycho-oncology care into the clinic. That's going to be our main focus. Our patients are your patients, but how do they get to us in psycho-oncology? I just want to start off in saying that not long ago, the thought of asking a patient with cancer to see a psychiatrist might have seemed somewhat cruel and unusual. This idea of applying psychological knowledge to patients in medical situations has a rich history. The history of psychosomatic medicine, issues like stress causing ulcers, the mind-gut connection, and other functional disorders without a physiologic correlate, is not unique to cancer. But the mind and cancer, many questions have been raised. Quite a few have been answered, but still we're left with the same intractable question. How do we get our patients to engage in psychological care? The answer, of course, depends on the patient, but it also brings up issues that fall into distinct categories. On the one hand, we understand the bidirectional relationship between neuropsychiatric complaints, fatigue, cognition, apathy, pain, depressive symptoms, or psychological issues and physiology. Then we understand that addressing these concerns is not just an added quality of life benefit, but impacts cancer-related outcomes and care. This should make psychosocial care not just ancillary, but an integral part of cancer care. Then we must think about and understand our approach as oncologists to the patient's mental health. But once the patient has engaged in psychosocial care, the oncologist still plays an integral role in supporting it so that it does not appear as an afterthought. This might mean addressing psychosocial referral care or follow-up appointments and how they're going, et cetera. I think Michelle and I share a similar fascination with understanding how we translate what psychiatry has to offer into the oncology setting. We see the longstanding focus on dealing with loss, certainly what could be more important to oncology, dealing with tragedy, allowing for the self to develop, as in self-determination, focusing on people's strengths and not just weaknesses, attention to the doctor-patient communication, and understanding the context of care. So many important items that apply to oncology as well as psychiatry. Our disciplines share many commonalities, but their diagnostic and treatment paradigms are fundamentally different, which can be frustrating. It may even cause inadvertent harm in some cases. Mental health is complicated because sometimes it follows that linear prescription of care and other times it doesn't. You learn early on in psychiatric training that the answer often depends, but it's the nuances that we love. As a gateway to understanding the patient's perspective, I will just say that as oncologists, we are generally getting just the tip of the iceberg. I often wish my psychiatry colleagues could see that, what I see as an oncologist. But it's this one-sidedness that makes the approach to psycho-oncology difficult. For example, something I've heard casually a number of times makes sense as an oncologist to say, when I see my patients struggle, most sort of psychologically, is when their disease is progressing. And when their disease is stable, they will be doing better in terms of their emotions. Yet I know when I put on my psychiatrist hat that half of my distressed patients are NED. Patients don't typically start coming to terms with their disease for 6 or 12 months after the diagnosis. Alternatively, I've heard things like, there's never enough of you. We could always have more psychosocial care. But this is fundamentally to misunderstand that we are dealing with diagnoses and a certain prevalence of symptom burden. So there's really a mismatch here, is what I want to bring up. People have always had unique ideas and perspectives around mental health. It's scary because what we do is grounded in science and in the discipline itself. And so it's a matter of understanding what we do. All of this is a little bit esoteric, I understand, but we want to get down to the nitty-gritty of how we get our care to patients with cancer. And so with this in mind, tell us, Michelle, about the fundamentals of distress screening, how it came about, and what it is.
Well, thanks a lot for that terrific introduction to some of the issues around psych oncology in general. Let me give you some of the background about distress screening and even the term distress. So Jimmy Holland, as you well know, was the chair of psychiatry at Memorial Sloan Kettering and recognized that, first of all, the literature and the research that had been done prior to, let's say, 1998, was not really adequate to address some of the issues that we needed to know about, like what was the impact of not addressing distress screening in the cancer clinic? What was the prevalence of various psychiatric conditions and patients coming to oncology care? And the differences between coming to a pancreatic cancer clinic versus a breast cancer clinic versus a leukemia clinic, et cetera. And so the literature was not very good. The research was not robust in the 1980s and 1990s regarding this, as we began to really understand the importance of recognizing mental health issues in the cancer clinic. Cancer centers were growing and the National Comprehensive Cancer Centers were being funded by the NCI to look at cancers in a different kind of way using large data sets. Dr. Holland was working with a large committee, and I was lucky enough to be on it, to begin with the help of the National Comprehensive Cancer Network to try to figure out how do we do better studies and how do we work with oncologists to try to figure out a lot of the questions that you just raised. How to bring psychosocial care into the cancer centers and therefore into the private cancer offices as well through regional and local education and work. We review the literature and try to understand the guidelines for this. And there were no guidelines really for how to do this. And through collaborative work and working with all the National Comprehensive Cancer Network centers at that time in around 1998, 1999, we developed a guideline for the first guideline on how to review this in the cancer clinics. And we used the word distress because there was a realization that if we use depression or anxiety or a psychiatric term, we would be missing the boat because we know that much of the distress, as you pointed out, you know, for example, in the first year after diagnosis, was often not related to a psychiatric condition, but to pain, to worry, to anxiety, to sleep problems, to the physical problems that cancer and its treatment might be playing in the patient's life. So we wanted to use a word that oncologists and patients and families and clinicians would recognize and then try to figure out based on algorithms how to get from distress from to a physical condition to spiritual conditions to practical conditions like transportation, towards financial issues, towards family issues, and then to psychiatric issues. And over the last 25 years, we have worked to come up with a new and an improved guideline each year using the National Comprehensive Cancer Networks, and it's grown over the years. We have representatives from all the various centers throughout the country, and it's a multidisciplinary group that has mental health professionals from all the disciplines, as well as oncologists, radiation oncologists, surgeons, palliative care specialists, as well as social workers, therapists, psychologists and psychiatrists, and clergy. And we've also developed something called the distress thermometer. From the very beginning, it was a 0 to 10 algorithmic scale that patients could easily look at the thermometer. It was likened to the pain thermometer at the time, which people and clinicians use regularly, asking where on the thermometer you're at today in terms of your pain. We thought that would be easy for patients to then switch over to this fifth vital sign, we call it. And we call it the fifth vital sign because, as patients know, when they come into the doctor's office, they're getting their temperature, their weight, their blood pressure, etc. And so asking about pain and then distress would be easy enough to do in the clinic setting by a medical assistant, by a nurse, by a mental health provider, by the oncologist. And it could be recorded in the patient's chart. And this could be put on a graph, or it would be easy to see how patients were doing over time. And that was the idea. In addition, the Institute of Medicine took this on, and with Dr. Holland's help, I think it was around 2006 and 2007, it became known through this IOM report that psychological care, psychosocial care was integral to the care of all cancer patients, and it should be measured and evaluated. And then the Commission on Cancer had this as commission, the American College of Surgeons Commission on Cancer required this at regular visits, that patients' distress should be evaluated. And so we have now a mandate at all cancer centers and in all, you know, regular clinic appointments to come up with a way that patients could be evaluated for distress. And now in many clinics, it's not a requirement to use the distress thermometer or the NCCN guideline per se, but it's a requirement here in the United States that all patients should be evaluated for some aspect of distress. And it could be depression, anxiety. Some clinics use the PHQ 2 or 9, and then a GAD to evaluate for anxiety. Some clinics also ask other batteries of questions, such as sleep, substance use questions, and trying to tailor it to the specific patient and specific circumstances, because we know that in addition to distress and cancer, we know that there's a very high prevalence of patients who have psychiatric conditions, distress, before they get cancer. A high percentage of patients have substance use problems, anxiety, and depression throughout their lifetime. And so we have to factor that in, that many patients have psychiatric conditions not related to cancer, may have a recurrence or an exacerbation, or have a new psychiatric condition or distress condition related to the cancer. In addition, many patients have other medical conditions, such as diabetes, heart disease, rheumatological problems. And so there are psychiatric conditions often associated with those medical problems as well. So it's important for patients to understand this, for families to understand this, for clinicians to understand that we can't overlook these issues. And why is that? Because it affects quality of life, because it affects the ability for patients to make decisions. It affects their ability to go along in a positive way with their protocols and treatment plans. And as we know, that when patients are often finished with their oncology treatments, what lingers is the psychosocial distress or distress. And so it's important for us into survivorship to also address these issues as well. So let me stop there and let me turn it back to you to see if you have any follow-up.
I think, to that. You know, that's wonderful, Michelle. And I think, you know, one thing I'll point out is the way in which, you know, fever is sort of nonspecific, right? A thermometer. We don't come from many, many different kind of etiologies. And so the same concept is happening with the distress thermometer. Distress in and of itself isn't a psychiatric diagnosis. And so that's also very important. And I think it's also kind of a place that could be a little bit confusing. But I think as you kind of outlined, there's a very clear reason, you know, why the term distress was chosen, and how it can be sort of all encompassing to capture all of these different issues. And like I said, I think the reason that's so important is because many of these issues just aren't apparent when, you know, patients come in to the clinic necessarily.
One of the first studies we did, I don't think we published it, but we did this study in our cancer center, and one of our child life social workers helped us with this, and another social worker. But the survey was, what do our adult patients who are waiting in the waiting room? And so it was patients who had different kinds of cancers who were waiting to be seen. And so it was a mixture of men and women and people with different kinds of cancers. And the number one anxiety was what to tell their children. So, you know, we might think that they were worried about what was going to happen in the treatment room or the treatment itself or, you know, something about the cancer, but it was more about their families and specifically about their children. So we don't know unless we ask people what's bothering them, what's distressing them. And that's why we have to do, we have to ask and we have to use standardized screens so that we don't have differential issues coming up because we're not asking the questions in a proper standardized way. And so that's why we have to do provide measurement-based care, evidence-based care, and then the evidence-based treatments to go along with the evidence-based questions that we're asking. And that's where we're at now, actually, at NCCN and with the distress guidelines. I think we have a really excellent guideline that, of course, can always be modified, but where we're at now is to now help clinicians in the oncology suites, help them deliver evidence-based care for those distressing issues that revolve around psychosocial problems.
Yeah.
And, so, you know, we can talk about that as well. We have gotten clinicians, oncology clinicians, to understand and buy in, and patients to understand and buy in, and mental health professionals that we need to do this for improvement in patient care and quality care. And now the issue is really more how to deliver that care.
Yes, I see that. I see that it seems that distress screening is being instituted fairly broadly. But one question I wanted to ask you, Michelle, do you have any thoughts on whether the oncologist should be aware of what the distress screen is? Because I've noticed in many places that often distress screening may run kind of parallel. It may happen within nursing or within some other capacity, and the oncologist isn't even aware that it's kind of been done. Do you have any thoughts about that? I don't know if that was how it was intended, or did it just evolve that way?
You know, I think 27 years ago or so when we started this, we didn't have Epic and we didn't have, a medical record that could be shared amongst different institutions and with patient portals. So we were not advanced back then, but now with the various systems, you know, one, if you go to a hospital in New York and then you come to Ann Arbor, we, with the patient's approval and consent, we can look at the records. And so we can have an integrated a record for patients, and we can actually follow a lot of the work and the care that the patients had in one system to another. And that includes emergency departments as well. So so we've improved that. We also, in terms of screening tools, many primary care clinics now, primary care clinics now require almost a screening of depression and the Columbia Suicide Rating Scale. So we can also follow that. So we have that information, and it gives us other data points that we can follow when we're seeing patients for oncology care. And that's really very, very helpful. So patients are used to this. And often patients are doing these screens, you know, a day or two before they're coming into the oncology clinic. And, you know, it's the responsibility of all of us who see the patient that day, whether the patient's going for an X-ray or the patient's going for chemotherapy, to look at the patient's record and see what the patient's, patient's input into those screens are, and whether we all should be using standardized scales so that we can sort of match them. And I think most of us are doing that at this point.
I was curious about your thought around that, because, you know, I feel like ideally oncologists should know where their patient's distress is. I could see that, you know, I think it happens that they're not always informed or aware of it. Like, I guess I think that it's important, because I know that oftentimes as we've stated, distress comes from many different places, but communication, you see this as well, I'm sure, that the patient misinterprets something that was said, or, you know, they're hung up on some part of an interaction or something like that. You know, it's an opportunity to correct and to educate, et cetera. And so, you know, just the idea that your patient might be suffering, you know, from something inadvertent, or that, could be easily corrected, is sort of concerning to me. So you also said about screening for depression, and I'll tell you, I've always, in looking at the literature and everything, I think you'll probably agree that it's depression is really the thing that we care about distress, we care about anxiety, we care about a lot of things, but in terms of outcomes, man, it's always depression that is associated with the worst of outcomes in terms of adherence to medications and even survival, et cetera. Do you think that we might be at a point where we might, like in primary care, just go ahead and actually screen for depression as well as distress? Or are we not there yet?
Well, we're doing it in many clinics now. For example, at our clinic, at our cancer center, the clinics can decide have options about what screens they want to use for their patients. So it's not mandated. And that's because patients are seen at various times, you know, whether they're in the bone marrow transplant clinic, survivorship clinic, or they're in the breast cancer clinic, they're being seen in different ways. So we've left it up to the, and different research protocols are being done. So we've left it up to the different clinics to decide. And some of them have decided to go with the PHQ. Some are promise scales. There, some of them are doing the distress limiter. And, you know, there are, you know, now there's growing literature about that. And, you know, high risk groups like head and neck cancer patients, even there are studies to look at the high prevalence of depression, anxiety, substance use in some of these populations, and whether or not even in a preventative prophylactic way to start antidepressants early would be beneficial to patients and their care. I think anxiety is probably as or even more problematic for patients than depression. You know, anxiety keeps people often from taking their aromatase inhibitors or, you know, or stay on maintenance medication for various conditions. And so we really have to measure and ask about that as well. And then substance use, you know, many patients are afraid to tell us about their substance use history, especially women. And they're afraid that we won't give them the treatment or the doses or let them be on certain trials. And so it's very important to talk about this, to ask about it, invite patients to tell us so that we can help them with addiction problems that are very, very prevalent and very difficult to get off of nicotine and other substances. And as you know, marijuana is being used, cannabis is being used in so many different states now. And many patients are having significant side effects from it. So it's important to ask, and then we have to make sure we have the resources and treatment to help them. And so, you know, a lot of in the old days, a lot of, I think, oncologists or surgeons were afraid to ask because if you asked, then you'd have to make sure you could deliver on the care. And maybe psychiatry wasn't so good about being there and being at the ready to help. We had a lot of, 25 years ago, there were insurance issues and it wasn't readily, these resources and care weren't readily available. You know, if you called up a psychiatrist, if you were an oncologist calling up a psychiatrist, you often wouldn't be able to get through or wasn't easy. And so, you know, it's been an important part of what we do as psychiatrists in the hospital and cancer centers to make ourselves available and to demonstrate that we could deliver on the care once that care was highlighted as needed by the oncologist, a surgeon, a radiation oncologist.
You have to say, I always have liked the idea of the vital sign, partly because, you know, using a scale, it brings up, you know, in your sort of clinical flow or practice, right? There's, you know, you interview a patient, you sort of do your thing. How do you incorporate scales? You know, and so I think, well, how you incorporate other signs, other, you know, so vital signs, et cetera, you know, other kind of lab data. You know, just sort of highlighting that this is something that, you know, when you're not used to doing it, it takes a little bit of time to really think about how you want to involve scales. And I think we're kind of moving in a direction where that's going to be more and more sort of a standard of care. And it really makes perfect sense because, you know, in between what we've been saying is the idea that, you know, we have our interview, we have our clinical judgment, but it's clear that so much more is available knowledge-wise about the patient through scales. And, you know, sometimes it's even just not only easier, but more comfortable. Like, there can be many reasons why, you know, the scales, you know, have their place. And I think even in psychiatry, it's not like we do this so readily in other areas. And so, you know, it's something, you know, to also kind of consider, I guess.
It's important to recognize that the distress thermometer is, you know, it looks like a regular thermometer, but to the side of it, the patient gets that thermometer to check to say whether there are four or seven or whatever. But the side part of it is where patients can check off what their distress is about, and they can they can check off many or none, but it gives them an opportunity to talk about pain and appetite and fatigue and energy and mood and anxiety and spiritual issues. And we look at that and we note that because that's what we, you know, that's what we want to talk about in the appointment. So it's a number, but it's also, you know, it's qualitative as well as quantitative. Yeah. And anybody who's listening can go on to the NCCN website and look at the distress guideline, because we have a patient-friendly distress guideline that's been translated into many languages, Spanish, French, et cetera, Chinese. And so it's a worldwide tool that doesn't cost any money. And it's important for patients and families to be proactive about this and maybe not wait for the oncologist or surgeon to raise this, but to say this is important to the care. And that's what we really wanted to make sure happens with this.
Yeah. And it's happening and will continue to happen. And it's a beautiful thing. I want to ask you, Michelle, say that I'm an oncologist and I'm seeing my patients in clinic. You know, aside from screening, you know, as we were talking about, how do you bring psychological care to patients, right? Okay, we identified screening, but you also mentioned, you know, a whole host of other issues, you know, substance abuse, potentially suicide, you know, all of these things. And I have to say that, you know, these are things that as an oncologist, you know, we can find it sort of daunting to have to, you know, not only are we thinking about the cancer, the family, communication, et cetera, but now we have all of this other stuff, you know, that we address on some level. But what would you recommend for an oncologist who obviously cares for the patient, wants the best for the patient, but isn't necessarily so comfortable in talking about all these issues? How do you start? Any recommendation for that oncologist who wants to start?
I've always thought that the oncologist is probably the doctor that's most able to think about a patient in the totality of it, because any symptom that the patient has, you know, could be related to the primary cancer, and so I've always thought about the oncologist in that way. And I think the oncologist has always been attentive to psychosocial issues. You know, what hasn't followed so much is the practicality of delivering that, the screening tool, the evidence base for treatment. So I think the oncologist has always been very sophisticated about understanding all this. And in fact, we have some problems because a lot of times patients start viewing the oncologist as their primary care doctor, and it really clogs up the system because, you know, but a lot of oncologists are very glad to take that on and be the first one to hear about a headache or a fever because you always want to make sure it's not the cancer or related to the treatment or the cancer. With that said, what at the recent NCCN meeting that we had last April, the oncologists were not asking us about the screening per se. They were saying, how do we actually deliver this on a practical level? And we've taken that to heart. And we're through a subcommittee of the NCCN Distress Guidelines with the leadership of Jess Fan from the University of Washington. We've taken this on and believe that a collaborative care model in oncology is probably the way to go. And so we've addressed this modifying the distress guidelines, and our whole committee has to review the recommendations for this. So it's not in the guideline right now. But we believe that just like in primary care, there's a collaborative care model. We think there needs to be a collaborative care cancer model that helps to begin to address how we can provide that care in a systematized way.
You know, one of the things I like about the collaborative care model, and we can highlight what that is for people, but is that it in a sense gets the oncologist's feet wet, and that it brings up sort of, thinking about these issues, because the problem is that, you know, there's no way to do all of this all at once, right? And so, you know, over time, as you're thinking more and more about, well, what is making my patient distressed, or, you know, how do I address the insomnia, or whatever the other issues are, it kind of gets easier. And what the collaborative care model, so I'll highlight it for people that may not be familiar, because the name itself is actually a little problematic, because we all do all kinds of things that are collaborative, but there for a long time has been this collaborative care model that has primarily been studied in primary care settings, but there are huge amounts of data also in oncology settings. And it has several key components. What it is it's proactive, it requires a screening tool, and it requires that after the patient who was screened, say using a distress thermometer or a PHQ-9 for depression, they meet with someone called a care manager and kind of go over what the issues are and enroll in the model. And then they're followed. And so the other part of it is that the care manager has to meet with a consultant psychiatrist once a week. And they basically go over how to triage what's going on. So that might mean sending the patient to receive psychotherapy. It might mean brief psychological kind of interventions like motivational interviewing. And it could be medication management. Oftentimes, the consultant psychiatrist might ask the oncologist, hey, would you mind starting, 5 milligrams of Lexapro or another medication? And then need be, obviously the patient could see the psychiatrist, but it allows for this kind of dissemination of skills and expertise across a kind of population. So it's sort of this population-based level of care. But one of the key things is that the oncologist actually bills for the care. So it's like a monthly, at least per CMS, like a monthly bill. And it, there's going to obviously be a lot of conversation between, say, that consultant psychiatrist and the primary, the oncologist, about individual patients, because that's kind of how you learn this. You need to learn it through dealing with individual patients. I think one of the things that's so challenging in doing this work is that it's emotionally laden. There's a lot in terms of dealing with death, mortality, and oncologists are people, right? And so we have our own feelings, and sort of separating those two out, can be challenging. It's a constant challenge. It's always challenging to do that. And so, I love the idea of a collaborative care model and seeing where that goes and sort of aligning our two fields a little bit more, because fundamentally, mental health needs to be right alongside cancer care, right?
Well, I think as you well pointed out, it's a population-based public health method of looking at the large numbers of patients. We have large numbers of people who have mental health issues, concerns, distress, and we have a large group of people who have oncology distress, concerns, problems. And if you look at that, you know, they overlap, but, and we're looking at that overlap group and how to best address those people individually. And, you know, we're looking at ways to destigmatize psychiatric conditions, and, you know, groups are terrific. We've been trying groups for medication as well as issues related to cancer, as well as issues related to psychiatric conditions. So why not put, for example, a patient with a history of bipolar disorder who now has melanoma, maybe we have a really terrific bipolar group going on in the Department of Psychiatry, and maybe that patient who's also getting care for melanoma might be able to take advantage of that being in that bipolar group. And there may not be any way that that patient or the oncologist would know about it. And it's through the care manager who could sort of bridge that. A lot of groups now are telehealth, so it's much easier now for patients to attend such a group.
The other thing too, Michelle, that I would point out is that, you know, the climate care model also speaks to one of the big problems that we have in psycho-oncology in terms of kind of matching patients with care, which is that, you know, if you think about it, this is always a point of, I guess, confusion, but because we're labeled psychiatrists, we are psychiatrists, but the patients that we're seeing are a different population than patients who would maybe be, you know, going to an outpatient psychiatric clinic. We have this term called serious mental illness that defines, you know, severe major depression, bipolar disorder, schizophrenia, psychotic disorders. But the vast majority of our patients in oncology, don't have those disorders. Some do, obviously, roughly 5% of the entire population. But the issue and what that means fundamentally is that patients may have a lot of good coping skills. They may have seen adversity, and they may, you know, but they need some help. They need not an inordinate amount of help, but some help, some smaller amount of help. And that's one of the things that the collaborative care model can sort of get at is, you know, is and it's a sort of a triaging kind of mechanism. But I think that sort of system-wide, that is an issue because there are only so many mental health clinicians out there. And it's not to take away care from somebody, but, again, everyone could sort of benefit, but the reality is that some people need more help than others. And, you know, finding that match is really challenging.
We also have the issue of cancer and severe mental illness. Patients who we have a disproportionate number of patients with severe mental illness who are going to come for oncology care without having had preventative screenings for cancer. We can talk about why that is, but so we do have many patients who are being seen by oncologists who may be in that group of patients who have severe mental illness. And really do need to see a mental health provider. And we don't want to start up a new psychiatric clinic per se in oncology, but we just want to get those patients through and take some of the burden off of the patient and the family and the oncologist for advising and helping and consulting on those patients.
You know, you know, I bring this point up because I hope it can be helpful for oncologists to think about the fact that, you know, here's my patient who, let's say, in several ways, maybe he or she had a family or they had a working career, et cetera, and they were able to function, you know, quote unquote, function in these different ways. That is something that is really important, because as patients, people face cancer, they're essentially facing adversity. Now, the tools that you use to face another kind of adversity might not work entirely well in this case. But again, if there's that history there, sort of prognostically, that sort of puts you at a higher, a place of doing better in the long term. And so, I think it's just something to kind of be aware of, because this whole idea can be sort of overwhelming, especially when you have a patient in your clinic who is emoting, crying, or maybe highly distressed. And a lot of what we deal with as psychiatrists is to sort of say that, well, is this maybe an appropriate response or not? And just because there's emotion, that doesn't mean that it's not appropriate or that it's sort of, pathological in some way. Just something to highlight. And hopefully as we move forward, I do see collaborative care coming down the pike, and I think it can be really helpful for oncologists, because something else I hear a lot is that they want to understand and sort of be more educated about these issues in and of themselves, because it's their patients. Thank you very much, Michelle, for coming on and speaking to me today about distress screening and about bringing psychosocial care to patients with cancer. Thank you so much.
Thank you. Appreciated the opportunity.
Don't forget to subscribe to the Oncology on the Go podcast on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or anywhere podcasts are available. Or listen online at cancernetwork.com/resources/podcasts. The Oncology on the Go podcast is the official podcast of cancernetwork.com, the home of the journal Oncology. For more information, visit us at cancernetwork.com and find us on X @CancerNetwork without the O, or on Facebook and LinkedIn @CancerNetwork.